What will Harry Potter do with the rest of his life? That is, after he defeats Voldemort and graduates from Hogwarts. Questions like that drove the thinking behind a new fantasy novel. It's a magical story in itself, and it's also a critique of the fantasy genre. Tom Vitale has our story.
On first glance, Lev Grossman's The Magicians looks very much like a Harry Potter story, only with slightly older characters and an American setting. The hero Quentin is a teenager from Brooklyn on his way to a Princeton admissions interview when he's whisked through a portal to an academy of magic called Breakbills. But Quentin differs from Harry Potter in that he reads fantasy novels, and he's enchanted to discover that the magic he's longed for all his life actually exists. Author Lev Grossman.
If I'd grown up the way Harry did, in an abusive, loveless step family, all I would have done was read fantasy. I would have been consumed by these just stories about escape and power. And I always wondered why Harry wasn't a fantasy reader.
Now 40 years old and the book critic for Time magazine, Grossman says when he was young, he was particularly taken with The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien and The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis. In Grossman's novel, the hero is obsessed with a series of books about a magical land called Fillory, which is much like Narnia. But at Breakbills, Quentin discovers that in real magic, things don't always work out the way they do in fantasy novels. When Quentin casts a prank spell in a magic class, he inadvertently summons a beast who eats one of his classmates.
Things like this didn't happen in Fillory. There was conflict and even violence, but it was always heroic and ennobling, and anybody really good and important who bought it along the way came back to life at the end of the book. Now there was a rip in the corner of his perfect world, and fear and sadness were pouring in like freezing filthy water through a busted dam.
Really, one of the coolest aspects of this book is that the students at Breakbills College act like real college students.
Elizabeth Hand reviewed The Magicians in the current issue of Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine. She says the novel is beautifully written, with well-drawn, believable characters.
I mean, these are kids or students who are having relationships with each other. Some of them are having, you know, romantic or sexual relationships. There are students who are gay as well as straight. Students occasionally making references to drugs. This is not your mother's Hogwarts.
If you could find them all, if you did destroy each Horcrux...
One destroys Voldemort.
How would you find them? They could be hidden anywhere, couldn't they?
True. But magic, especially dark magic...
In the Harry Potter books and their film adaptations, as in most fantasy stories, there is a powerful, malevolent being, a Voldemort or Sauron, who the hero fights in an epic battle. Lev Grossman says he purposely left the villain out of his fantasy novel.
Voldemort and anyone like that in a fantasy novel, any big bad villain, has a kind of powerful organizing presence on the universe. You know who's good, you know who's evil, and you know what magic is for. It's for fighting evil. Well, when you take that away, suddenly the universe gets a whole lot more complicated. Suddenly it's all shades of gray, and it's not clear who belongs where, and it's not clear what magic is for.
In the end, the young magicians in Grossman's novel do use their magic to battle evil when they discover a portal to the magical realm of Fillory, which they thought only existed in their novels. With Fillory, Grossman says he wanted to reinterpret the Narnia of C.S. Lewis and the role of the lion god Aslan, also depicted in a film adaptation.
Aslan, we need your help.
I know, but understand, the future of Narnia rests on your courage.
I remember being very angry as a child and as an adult at Aslan. I always felt that here was a world that had a proper god in it, a god who you could see, who would come down and change the course of events. But he didn't do it very much. And he would often let battles go on and events really spin out of control, and people would die before Aslan would step in. Why would a god not help people in every possible way that he could?
So in The Magicians, Quentin and his colleagues confront the god of Fillory, a ram named Ember, demanding to know why he let his people suffer. The Magicians is Lev Grossman's third novel and his first fantasy book. Grossman says he used to care about being a literary novelist, but now all he cares about is telling a good story.
There's a strong tradition in the 20th century that is against storytelling, that is against plot. I wanted to move past that. I wanted to write something that was pure pleasure and pure storytelling. And I felt that in doing so, you didn't have to give up the kind of beautiful, lyrical, self-aware literary language that we associate with literary novels.
Lev Grossman says now he's writing a sequel to The Magicians. He says magic is a perfect metaphor for the power of language, that words can cast a spell and change the universe. For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
We go now from the digital library to an older literary tradition, the summer reading list for kids. If you have school-aged children, they may well be working their way through such a list right now. And we wanted to take a few minutes to put together our own list of classics for young adults. To do that, we called Leslie Bloom. She's the author of several books for young readers, most recently Tennyson. Leslie joined us from our bureau in New York. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You know, I notice when I look at your list that there isn't any book published after 1983, and you include one book that was written in 1924. I guess that means that these must have been books that you read when you were a kid.
I did, and one of the beauties of this list is that parents will love to rediscover these titles. The book that you're referring to, my 1924 book on this list, is The Boxcar Children, which actually was a mini-book series by Gertrude Chandler Warner. It's the story of four orphan siblings who run away from their orphanage and create a home for themselves in an abandoned boxcar in the forest. And I think that the idea of just basically setting up shop and running your own show is always enticing. No rules, no baths, no schoolwork, not being told what to do. The environment is enticing because it's unusual and also because it's totally free and the children actually themselves become adults.
Now, you put a book on this list by Roald Dahl, who's of course very well known for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and James and the Giant Peach and other children's classics. But you picked one that I haven't heard of, The Witches, which you say is scary.
I really, really love The Witches. And, you know, a lot of children's literature is traditionally very scary and very frightening. And but in a tantalizing way. What happens in this book is a 7-year-old boy, orphaned, of course, because all children's book characters always have to be orphaned, goes to live with his grandmother. And it turns out that his grandmother is an expert on witches. And the two of them come across a well-connected organization of witches, which is launching a nefarious plot to destroy children, all the children in the country.
Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, dun. And it turns out that the witches look like ordinary people, which is quite amazing. And the reader is told, quote, "Real witches dress in ordinary clothes and look very much like ordinary women.
Oh,
they
my goodness.
Live in ordinary houses and work in ordinary jobs. That is why they are so hard to catch." And without spoiling the ending, I will say that it has not exactly a fairy tale ending in that everything ends happily. And, you know, life is not about neat, perfect endings. This book does not have one. Kids know the difference. They don't like condescending authors. They like it when people give it to them straight. And Roald Dahl has definitely given them that in this book, albeit in a very whimsical package.
You also picked The Devil's Storybook by Natalie Babbitt. And that was the book on the list that you thought we might hear a little bit from, a reading.
Natalie Babbitt, most people probably know her for her classic Tuck Everlasting, which is a beautiful
right.
book. And The Devil's Storybook I don't think was ever hugely popular, I think because it was a little contentious, the idea of writing a collection of short stories about a devil who is sort of a naughty rogue. He's really funny. And hell is not what you would expect. He's not what you would expect. And I just wanted to read you a very short little paragraph from the very first story in the book called Wishes. And it starts, "One day, when things were dull in hell, the devil fished around in his bag of disguises, dressed himself as a fairy godmother, and came up into the world to find someone to bother. He wandered down the first country road he came to, and before long he met a crabby farm wife stumping along with a load of switches on her back." And that's the end of the paragraph. And I love the idea of things being dull in hell. And I like the idea that the devil has nothing better to do but go around and bother people and pester them, dress up as fairy godmothers, that he has a ready array of costumes. I mean, the language of a lot of these classic children's books is absolutely wonderful. And we have to make sure that the books that we love go into the hands of our own children.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Leslie Bloom is the author of several books for young readers. Her most recent book is called Tennyson.
It's a Southern Gothic mystery novel. And if you want to look at Leslie Bloom's complete list of books for kids, plus find summer reading recommendations for adults, look at the new NPR.org.
Our Crime in the City series resumes this week. We've been talking with mystery writers across the country and around the world, and this week we'll have stories from Paris, Berlin, and Beijing. We will start the series today in London. Now, if you favor a nice whodunit set in the jolly English countryside with kindly vicars and fresh-faced debutantes riding to hounds, then whatever you do, do not pick up any of Mark Billingham's novels. Reporter Vicky Barker recently went for a walk with Billingham. It was London, but not as you know it.
A murderer stalks the homeless through a London night that, in author Mark Billingham's words, stinks of desperation.
He turned from Dean Street onto Old Compton Street, heading towards Piccadilly, past the cruisers and the coked-up media wankers, past a wild-haired wino breathing heavily and scowling at the world from the doorway of a fetish wear boutique. As he walked, he realised where that dull ache came from. It was the effort of staying self-contained that drained you, of keeping yourself impervious to the offers and the pleas, to the promises of pleasure of one sort or another.
Mark Billingham, reading from his 2006 novel, Lifeless.
So this is Leicester Square. Looks lovely now, doesn't it?
On a bright weekday lunchtime, Billingham, a stand-up comic, children's writer, and crime novelist, retraces a murderer's steps and describes his own restless quest for settings.
You write a better scene if you've gone down to the place where it's set. I had to do some stuff right on the banks of the Thames. And I look to my left and there's a huge, blown-up, dead dog. You know, stuck in the sludge, it's blown up like a kind of space hopper, kind of snarling. And I look to my right and there's a beautiful heron perched on it. And I kind of think, you know what, I could have sat in my office for 2 or 3 hours and I'd never have made that stuff up.
The result, novels in which beauty and horror, tragedy and black comedy interlock. Characters drawn from society's margins collide with the law or with each other in settings which, though familiar to most Londoners, have been rendered sinister or disturbing.
It's fun to write about what's hidden, because it has this kind of facade. It's touristy and wonderful, and look, we've got the royal family and Big Ben and the Houses of Parliament, the Tower of London, you know, but you don't have to look very far to find not only a fantastically dark present, but a really evocative dark history.
In one novel, In the Dark, present and past collide when a gang of young black drug dealers falls foul of an old-style East End gangster.
This week's big issue, please. Issue, please.
In Billingham's book Lifeless, street people like this man selling the homeless magazine The Big Issue are not background color, but central players in a parallel society to ours, one Billingham discovered while researching the book.
There's a homeless opera company. There are homeless football leagues. There's a homeless theatre company. There's a whole world, a whole community, which I kind of discovered, with its own hierarchy. The drinkers don't hang out with the drug addicts. The drug addicts are suspicious of the people with mental illness. They're all suspicious of the immigrants. There's a real kind of society going on just beneath the surface.
As the tourists mill around Leicester Square, buying half-price theatre tickets and bumping into nothing more sinister than each other, Billingham watches from his own darker vantage point, drawn from his years playing the local comedy clubs.
You come into Leicester Square 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and it's like the seventh circle of hell. You're like, just don't look anybody in the eye, don't look anybody in the eye. So look in the... It's how I kind of always imagined New York used to be. I was never a fan of cosy mysteries, of anything set in the countryside. You know, I just don't care. I'm a city boy. I grew up in a big city in Birmingham, and I want to write about a city. It's a much richer tapestry for me than Greenfields. Fields and wildlife make me feel ill. I don't want to write about that stuff.
Billingham has a lived-in face, a pierced ear. He speaks in quick staccato bursts, a raconteur's voice. Some readers may find his police inspector hero, Tom Thorne, less engaging. He seems more sketchily described than the criminals and the scenery. Billingham says he consciously chose to make Thorne a work in progress.
I really genuinely don't. The reader knows as much about Tom Thorne as I do at any one time. What that does mean is that sometimes he goes into areas that readers are uncomfortable with.
One of the most uncomfortable moments in his novels is a scene where Thorne is tied up and subjected to a very graphic sexual attack. And now Billingham reveals that he, too, was the victim of a violent attack a year before he started writing the Thorne novels. It happened at a hotel in the city of Manchester.
I got room service in this room one night, and there was a knock on the door about half an hour later, and I thought they'd come to collect the tray, you know, the empty plate, and there was three guys in ski masks, and they just burst in and said they were going to kill me and tied me up and put a bag over my head.
The men took Billingham's credit cards and held him there for 3 hours. He says the experience marked him as a crime writer in two significant ways.
In that first book, it was really important to me that the victim had a voice and was somebody that you cared about. And secondly, I think one thing I can write about pretty well is what it's like to be afraid. I'm pretty good on fear. I remember when I was tied up in that hotel room, I was bouncing off the carpet because my heart was thumping so much. I can remember literally bouncing on the floor. And so, yeah, I can write about what it's like to be afraid, I think.
Did that in any way inform your decision to start writing crime fiction? An interruption. A twitchy, rail-thin guy with X-ray eyes, right out of one of Billingham's novels.
When I was walking down the road one day, I saw a beautiful girl, she was ginger every day. I said, "No, my darling, you look really cold. Do you want me to warm you up?" She said, "No, go away." I said, "Later."
There you go.
Yes.
That's London right there. That was very impressive. That guy, you know, I'm not being judgmental, but that guy's an addict. And there are a lot of characters like that wandering around. I don't know how he's going to fill up his day, but I kind of know where he's going to finish up tonight.
The police, by the way, never caught the guys who attacked Mark Billingham. He says they never came close. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
And Mark Billingham's new Inspector Thorne novel, Death Message, is out in October. You can read an excerpt and check out other recommendations from our Crime in the City series at thenew.npr.org.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.